Hello, everyone, and welcome to On Science, the weekly podcast from NPR's Science Desk. I'm Adam Cole, an intern here. This week, we bring you stories from Japan, where citizens endure aftershocks, power outages, and spreading radioactive contamination. Scientists are trying to understand the accident at Fukushima Daiichi Power Plant by tracking the radiation, and someday soon, using robots to look inside the damaged reactor buildings. And at the end of the program, a newly excavated site in Texas might settle the debate about just when humans first arrived in America. But first, rolling blackouts are expected to continue in the Tokyo area for months, and that's largely because of the damaged nuclear plant. The giant utility that serves the region, Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, has lost 20% of its power capacity. As NPR's John Itzde reports, the blackouts are crippling businesses, from auto producers to fishmongers.
Even on a slow day, Tsukiji Market, the world's largest fish market, is a beehive of activity. Motorized carts buzz down narrow aisles carrying tuna carcasses. They're sawed into chunks and shipped to restaurants in Tokyo and around the world. Normally, these aisles would be jammed with buyers. Today, they're empty. Mr. Karu, a wholesaler, blames the blackouts.
I predict one-third of these wholesalers in this market will close the shop, the business. Main reason is the power source.
The rolling blackouts are reducing train service, making commuting unpredictable, so people don't stay downtown eating and drinking after work. The result is fish sales at Tsukiji are down about 50%. In the morning, the blackouts mean some rail commuters can't get to work on time. That's a problem for the big auto manufacturer, Nissan.
Electricity going down creates its own damage.
Andy Palmer is a senior vice president at Nissan. He's trying to get the company's auto plants up and running. But he's plagued by power outages that shut down production and damage equipment.
Certainly the power outages are something that we're having to work with. Obviously, it's partially a negotiation with the local authorities.
But so far, TEPCO, one of the biggest privately owned power companies in the world, says it can't guarantee power to anyone. TEPCO says, when blackouts are required, we do not discriminate among our customers, whether industrial or residential. The problem is these rolling blackouts could continue for many months, even years.
This is a real problem for those factories which need uninterrupted supplies.
Professor Tatsuo Ohata, president of the National Graduate Institute for Policy Studies in Tokyo, says the situation might cause some companies to move.
It's clear that from their viewpoint, they'd better move their plant to the western part of Japan, where electricity is plenty.
But wouldn't it be much easier to send the surplus power from one side of Japan to the other to ease the blackouts? Well, that's harder than you might think, says Professor Hata.
One major problem is that the east and west of Japan have different electric cycles, and the capacity of the connectors are very much limited.
That's partly an accident of history. Eastern Japan followed the German model and has a 50-cycle electrical power grid. The West used the American model and has a 60-cycle grid. Transferring power from one grid to another requires a very expensive facility, and there are currently just 3 connections between eastern and western Japan. That bottleneck means the power transfer is just a trickle, even during this national emergency, and creating more capacity would take years. Hata says up until now, Japan's big utility companies, including TEPCO, liked the arrangement because it protected their monopoly pricing and made them very powerful politically.
The users of electricity, like Japan Steel, wouldn't say anything against electric utility companies. I mean, they are so much afraid. And also, many politicians wouldn't touch those electric utility companies.
Hata says the situation must change to reduce the stranglehold Japan's utilities have on the country's energy users.
One possibility is that on this occasion, Japanese government nationalize TEPCO.
The government could keep TEPCO's transmission lines and sell off its power plants to smaller producers who would compete to sell power to customers. For the time being, TEPCO says it's doing everything it can to secure more power. The stakes are incredibly high. Power consumption normally doubles during the heat of the summer. Right now, it seems unlikely TEPCO will be able to meet the demand, threatening more disruption for Japanese companies and workers and greater damage to Japan's fragile economy. John Idsti, NPR News, Tokyo.
Workers at the Fukushima Daiichi plant hope they will soon get a look inside the damaged reactors. So far, nobody knows how much damage there's been to the containment systems that normally keep radioactive material from escaping. The intense radiation inside the reactor buildings means it's too dangerous for workers to enter. But a small team of American robots is getting ready to go in. Jeff Brumfiel is a reporter with the scientific journal Nature, and he's been covering the nuclear emergency.
Robots are good at going places where people just don't want to go.
The purpose of robots is to do those dull, dirty, and dangerous missions. So dangerous is certainly what we're talking about here.
Tim Trainer is a vice president at iRobot, a Massachusetts company that has sent four of its robots to help out at the Fukushima Daiichi plant. The massive earthquake and tsunami that struck the plant on March 11th caused extensive damage. Explosions and fires that followed knocked out valuable equipment and left the area dangerously radioactive.
A lot of the sensors and cameras are no longer operative in the facility, so the robot can provide your eyes and ears.
These robots were originally designed to investigate bombs for the military, and some have been used in Iraq and Afghanistan. There are two types, both of which look like little tanks, about 3 feet long. Mounted on the front is an extra set of extendable treads, or flippers, which can help them scale obstacles.
Both of them are very maneuverable. They both have the ability to climb stairs. They have the ability to move over rocks and terrain and debris.
That could come in handy at Fukushima Daiichi, where the accident has strewn rubble around the plant. The robots also come equipped with cameras, chemical and radiation sensors. One type has a robotic arm that should be able to open the door of a reactor building, unless it's locked.
I am not familiar with what the door is like and whether they lock the door. If they lock the door, likely we will not be able to open them.
Once the robots get inside, and by the way, Trainer is pretty sure that they will, they could use their cameras to inspect the condition of the containment vessel around the reactor or take samples to check for radiation levels. This will all help officials to determine the extent of the damage, but it's only the start of what robots might do at Fukushima. Red Whitaker is a researcher at Carnegie Mellon University who has assisted with robotic operations at nuclear accidents like Chernobyl. After that accident, radiation levels were too high for workers to conduct cleanup operations, so remote-controlled robots had to take over.
The building around Chernobyl, so that's sometimes called the sarcophagus, was put together by remoted cranes that would lift and lower beams and tilt up walls, and by robots in the interior that would cut and dig.
At Fukushima, Whitaker says he expects a whole variety of different devices, especially given the Japanese aptitude for robotics. Some might be used to handle dangerous nuclear fuel, for example, while others remove radioactive topsoil around the plant.
I would anticipate that we are going to see a phenomenal enterprise of remote work systems that are brought to bear over the weeks, months, and years of recovering Fukushima.
The iRobot team is now working with the nuclear plant's employees. If all goes according to plan, the robots could enter the site in a matter of days. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
Jeff has also been keeping an eye on the radioactivity spreading from the plant. A global network of sensors, originally set up to detect nuclear weapons testing, is tracking the radiation across oceans and continents. Now, scientists hope it can tell them more about the accident.
The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization began setting up its monitoring stations about a decade ago. The eventual goal is to enforce a worldwide ban on nuclear weapons tests. Here's spokesperson Annika Thurberry.
we have currently over 280 sensors worldwide monitoring underground, the atmosphere, the oceans for any sign of a nuclear explosion, and we're also sniffing the air for any sign of radioactivity.
That now includes radioactivity from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Explosions at three reactors and a fire at a spent fuel pool have released radiation into the atmosphere. Gerhard Votova is with the Austrian Meteorological Service and has been studying data coming from the monitoring stations. He says there's no doubt what they're picking up is coming from Japan.
Data like that, I mean, I've never seen it in my career, so it is pretty much clear where it comes from.
The sensors are registering radioactive elements like iodine-131 and cesium-137. These are byproducts from nuclear fission inside the core of a reactor. Votova has been feeding the data into computer models that can forecast where the radiation will go. He also uses the models to work backwards and calculate the amount of material first released. Based on those calculations, he says the accident, in some ways, is roughly the size of Chernobyl.
The daily release is comparable with what was set free in Chernobyl. Yeah. However, the effect of the power plant accident to Japan is not comparable with the effect of the Chernobyl accident to the former Soviet Union.
That's partly because Chernobyl was located inland and radiation contaminated land in all directions. Fukushima is on the coast, and winds are blowing much of the material out over the Pacific. Votova's calculations are just an estimate, and not everyone agrees the accident is comparable to Chernobyl.
If I had to guess, I would say that the release levels were more like Three Mile Island and less like Chernobyl, but we'll see as time goes forward.
Harry Miley is a nuclear physicist at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Washington State. He says analyzing the types and amounts of radioactive material picked up by the sensor network will tell researchers around the world more about what happened inside the reactors at Fukushima.
We might determine things like what was the temperature of the material when the radioactivity was emitted, which materials it was. There's three reactors and there's spent fuel pools and so forth. They're all potential sources. And we should be able to nail down which source is which.
For now, it may be the only way to tell what's happened. Radiation levels on the site are far too high to take a direct look. The sensors should also provide people with a sense of reassurance. Even though the radiation from the plant has been picked up across the United States, Miley says that the levels aren't dangerous.
The highest detection that we've gotten in the U.S. has been far lower than the natural radioactivity that's normally there. So I don't think that there's any increased risk to the U.S. public.
And there's more good news. The latest readings here in America seem to indicate that radiation from the plant is falling. Miley is hopeful that the worst of the accident may be behind us. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
No country is more familiar with nuclear peril than Japan. The atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 at the end of World War II killed or irradiated hundreds of thousands of Japanese. So you might think that people in that country would be traumatized by the crippled nuclear power complex. But, as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, the reality is more nuanced.
From one generation to the next, even the most horrible events fade from cultural memory. Isao Hashimoto, an artist in the city of Hakone, wants people to remember 1945.
I had heard from my father, my grandfather, about the war, seriousness of war, and the seriousness of atomic bombs. So I think we should keep talking about this problem, especially towards the younger generation.
So Hashimoto created a very simple video, just a map of the world. Starting in 1945 with the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, it registers in chronological order every nuclear test explosion. One after another, each bomb shows up as a little red puff on the screen.
The beep means each explosion. Another beep means the 1 month for more than 2,000 tests.
Fear of radiation burrowed into Japanese culture. Godzilla, the movie monster that destroyed Tokyo, was the spawn of radioactive fallout, as were other cinema monsters to follow. On the positive side, animators created the helpful cartoon robot Atom Boy, who uses science for peace. That was fantasy, but now in Japan, the fallout is real again. It's even reached Tokyo. At a restaurant in Tokyo, Tsukuyasu Yamamoto orders lunch.
I think it's cod and kelp.
No one's ordering spinach these days. The government says crops to the north are contaminated. Yamamoto is a nuclear physicist, trained at Yale University and now teaching in Tokyo. He knows both cultures. He says the reaction to the nuclear accident can be described in a word.
Gaman is to endure, accept that pain, don't complain.
He says another word, shikata ganai. It means it can't be helped. And in a sense, that's the situation here. Japan needs electricity, and there's little coal and no oil domestically. The government cast the country's lot with nuclear power and built 55 reactors that generate about 35% of the country's electricity. Yamamoto says many people here don't really associate the horrors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with this nuclear reactor accident.
The tsunami is more like the atomic bomb effect of flattening the whole place. And the radiation is another disaster which may be more hazardous than tsunami in some ways, the long-lasting. But most people are not scientists, so they don't make that connection very easily.
In fact, Yamamoto says many of his students don't seem to know much about World War II and the bombings. He says people of his generation do remember. 2 years ago, Yamamoto rediscovered the diaries he kept as a teenager during the war.
These are the diaries. They're starting from April 27, 1945. May 1st. Today, we heard about my father's death in action.
Sitting in an armchair at his tidy home in Tokyo, Yamamoto looks for an entry he made about the atomic bombs that America dropped on August 6th and August 9th.
This is August 13th. Today, a small aircraft came over. So that was more scary because the one plane can do it. I think, if I remember, there are only two planes over Hiroshima.
For sure, people near the damaged nuclear complex in Fukushima are worried about their health, their food supply. But farther away, many Japanese people are more devastated by the tsunami. Some find it rather odd that Americans are worried about a plume of radiation thousands of miles away. Yoshiko Suzuki is a bereavement counselor in Tokyo.
My youngest daughter lives in San Francisco. She is scared to death and worry about me, like, Mommy, why don't you get out of Japan and come here?
There are others who don't share Suzuki's complacency about the goings-on in Fukushima. Seiji Arihara is a filmmaker whose animated movie Nagasaki 1945 describes the bombing and a hospital in that city treating survivors.
In my movie, I wanted to give out a message that humans can't live with radiation. It's just not possible.
So far, there hasn't been a groundswell of anti-nuclear demonstrations. The people I talk to say Japan has more immediate concerns. That becomes clear as I sit in a Tokyo office interviewing Arihara. Translator Koki Ishibashi's cell phone rings an alert.
Oh, I think this is an earthquake. Earthquake in Fukushima.
I feel it.
I guess it's shaking, yeah.
The quake's epicenter is, again, right near the nuclear power complex. Christopher Joyce, NPR News, Tokyo.
People like to know when and where their ancestors came from. Conventional wisdom has held that the first Americans arrived here about 13,000 years ago, but there have been hints from excavation across America that humans may have shown up here considerably earlier. And now, an excavation site in Texas seems to confirm that idea. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
Picture the scene. It's 15,000 years ago, and you've arrived in what's now Texas. You've been traveling for a long time. Your ancestors actually started this journey in Siberia, and now you're ready to stay put for a while. So you look up the local real estate agent, and he takes you to a spot in a pleasant tree-covered valley. Location, 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 says the agent.
First off, you have a small spring-fed stream, which has water in it year-round, which is, you know, pretty good for Texas.
Okay, okay, Michael Waters isn't really a real estate agent. He's the director of the Center for the Study of the First Americans at Texas A&M University. But he sounds a bit like a real estate agent when he describes the advantages of a spot he's excavated north of Austin.
You can go north to the Blackland Prairies. You can stay in the Edwards Plateau. You can go south and head out into the Gulf Coastal Plain. And there you have various, you know, animal and plant resources at your fingertips.
Another advantage is there's plenty of chert nearby. Chert is a kind of quartz you can use to make sharp blades. Waters knows humans spent time at the spot, known as the Buttermilk Creek Complex, because he's found more than 15,000 artifacts there.
Most of those artifacts are small flakes or chips that are left behind from the making of stone tools and the resharpening of stone tools.
What makes these tools particularly interesting is they come from a layer of soil that's below the level where tools from another early human culture had already been found. Those tools were made by people known as Clovis. For a long time, archaeologists have thought that the Clovis were the first American tourists from Siberia.
Clovis is typically dated now between about 13,100 and about 12,800 years ago.
As he reports in the journal Science, Waters and his colleagues believe the artifacts they've found were made by people who preceded the Clovis to Texas by more than 2,000 years. Waters says the newly discovered tools are mostly small, suggesting they were made by a culture that liked to travel light. Tom Dillehay of Vanderbilt University says in recent years, many scientists have questioned the idea that Clovis really were the first Americans. He's not certain the findings from Buttermilk Creek will settle the issue.
Whether or not they're really pre-Clovis or really early Clovis is somewhat, I think, questionable.
Dillehay says it will take more excavating and better dating techniques to settle that question. But there are several sites that point to human settlement in the Americas earlier than Clovis.
This particular report that just appeared is yet another, if you want to put it that way, nail in the Clovis coffin.
James Adavasio is the executive director of the Mercyhurst Archaeological Institute. He's done his own excavating at a site near Buttermilk Creek. He says while it's probably not Clovis, scientists just don't know who were the first humans to claim real estate in North America.
Everything we're learning now from genetics, from linguistic data, from geological data, from archaeological data, suggests that the peopling process is infinitely more complicated.
That's the thing about science. Every time you learn something new, things that once seemed clear can become less clear. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Everywhere around the world, they're coming to America. Every time that flag's unfurled, they're coming to America.
That's all for this week's Science Podcast. You can find all the stories you heard today at npr.org/sciencepodcast. And you can send questions or suggestions to sciencepodcast@npr.org. I'm Adam Cole. Have a great week.